journalism is to question the prevailing wisdom. Question the prevailing wisdom.
Just speak the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass dissent.
These are weapons of mass dissent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Tuesday, May 26, 2009, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar.
It just makes me stop and think.
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 Silence is not an option.
Environmental activists decry new climate legislation, a new report on the true cost of Chevron, and celebrating 100 years of the Progressive magazine, plus this week's Empire Notes.
This is Uprising.
Good morning and welcome to Uprising. I hope everyone had a good Memorial Day weekend. Well, today is a very important day that people around the country are paying attention to. The state Supreme Court here in California will make its decision on Proposition 8. The announcement will be made today at 10 a.m. and we'll have special coverage on the outcome, whichever way it goes, on tomorrow's edition of Uprising. But first, our story about climate legislation. Last Thursday, a key committee in the House of Representatives approved sweeping legislation intended to address the gathering threat of global warming. Introduced by Democratic Representatives Henry Waxman and Ed Markey, the American Climate and Energy Act of 2009 sets out to reduce greenhouse gas emissions to 17% below 2005 levels by 2020. Central to obtaining the bill's emission standard, which is lower than what had been originally suggested, is the market-based cap-and-trade approach. Through government caps and industry trades, the legislation claims the system will spur the development of renewable energy sources while lowering emissions. However, many environmental groups, including Greenpeace, have criticized the cap-and-trade system as inefficient to deal with the problem of global warming and are subsequently not lending their support to the bill. Other criticisms by environmentalists include the proposed climate legislation's classification of renewable energy, which labels solid waste incinerators, for example, as a waste-to-energy project. The Breakthrough Institute, an Oakland-based think tank, has suggested that the presence of such loopholes in the Waxman-Markey bill could actually lead to an increase in emissions by 2030. My guest is Daphne Wysham. She is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and the director of the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network. Welcome to Uprising, Daphne.
It's good to be with you.
So first, why don't you explain what a cap-and-trade system exactly means? I mean, when we're talking about global warming, when we're talking about the changing of the climate and greenhouse gas emissions, what's going on with industry trading? Why is that involved?
Well, you know, it's an approach that began in the United States in the 1990s to address the problem of acid rain. And while there have been plenty of critics of that particular approach, it's commonly in the mainstream press, it's viewed as a huge success, a much more successful program than so-called command and control or regulatory approaches to reducing the pollutants that caused acid rain. And because it was considered a success, they then went on to say, well, we can do the same sort of cap-and-trade program globally with greenhouse gases. Now, for acid rain, all you have to do is install a scrubber in a smokestack, and you can capture some of the pollutants that cause acid rain. With climate change, you're talking about rejiggering the entire the foundation of our global economy, the energy that underlies our entire way of life. So it's a much more complicated problem to address. And as we've seen in its implementation in countries in Europe and as well as in the trading programs between the developed and the developing countries, it's riddled with flaws, it's prone to corruption, and in many cases, it actually results in a growth in greenhouse gas emissions.
Well, what is being capped and what's being traded specifically?
Well, the theory is this, that you set a cap for greenhouse gas emissions within an economy, and then you are allowing industries to trade back and forth amongst themselves. So, for example, if a steel corporation couldn't reduce its greenhouse gas emissions as cheaply as a cement kiln could, they may be able to trade so that the steel corporation would be able to buy emissions credits from the cement kiln and thereby count its overall, count the emissions as part of an overall emissions reduction target. So the cement kiln would go down further, the steel producer would be allowed to increase its emissions slightly, but overall, the theory is overall the emissions would be reduced.
It would
just be more efficient.
Now, the cap is only on what a certain company then can produce. It's not an overall cap. You can't say to the industry that overall we're going to cap it, or can you?
Well, the approach that's being put forward by the Waxman-Markey bill is trying to cap all of the industries over a certain production level. So if they produce a certain amount of energy, 20,000 BTUs, for example, they would be part of this overall nationwide cap. Now, the problem is that the cap has all sorts of loopholes. And the biggest loophole is that it allows for 2 billion tons of so-called carbon offsets, which are different from trades. A carbon offset is where, say we had that same example of the steel and the cement factory trading with each other, and neither one was able to still meet their target even with this trading. They could then set aside, say, a forest and call that a carbon offset and say, well, that forest that we're going, we would have cut this forest down, but now we're going to keep it standing, and therefore all of the CO2 that's now being captured by that forest will count towards our target. Or they could say, we're going to capture methane from a landfill and we're going to burn it, and instead of allowing that methane, which is 25 times more potent than CO2, to be released into the atmosphere, we're turning it into CO2, which is far less potent, a global warming gas, by burning it, and therefore all of that methane that would have been released into the atmosphere now has a price on it. We've counted that towards our target, and therefore we've achieved our goal. Now you can just see from you know, on the face of it,
it's complicated.
It's not only complicated, it's riddled with all sorts of funny math. I mean, for example, how do you know that that methane wouldn't be captured anyway?
Right.
How do you know that that forest wouldn't be protected anyway? And what do you do if that forest goes up in flames due to, for example, climate change and warming temperatures?
Right. Do you then count that off your carbon credits?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. What happens to that? It's all of a sudden, it's been sold on the market. Do you go back and demand that the landholder pay? No, of course that wouldn't happen.
Right.
So it's one reason why the U.S. Government Accountability Office has said it's virtually impossible to verify carbon offsets.
But now, is that part of this important piece of legislation?
It's a absolutely fundamental piece of this legislation. 2 billion tons of carbon offsets per year is equivalent to 30% of U.S. greenhouse gas emissions.
So what is going on here with these Democratic representatives, Henry Waxman and Ed Markey, who are not necessarily conservative Democrats?
No.
Why did this, and, you know, the understanding is that Representative Waxman really rushed this through the process. I'm not even sure if it had a subcommittee hearing. What happened, and what do you think is going on here in terms of just the legal wrangling over getting this bill through?
Well, you know, there are a lot of things we don't fully understand about what's being discussed behind the scenes. I do know, though, because I've been following this process for a number of years and was actively engaged in helping to draft some climate principles amongst various members of Congress, that it is possible and feasible to get to much stronger targets. And in fact, we are called upon to go to much stronger targets in terms of overall emissions reductions. Our targets are somewhere between 25 and 45% below 1990 levels by 2020. and we are nowhere near that with 17%. And then we're also basically redefining renewables under this bill. So,
and explain that for a second as well. Renewable energy. What are the sort of loopholes created here?
Well, there are strong renewable energy targets as part of this bill, as are their strong energy efficiency targets, which on the surface seems like a really good thing. But then when you start unpacking how do they define renewable energy, that's where you begin to realize by keeping the price of carbon so low, and this again, sorry, this is all very complicated, but it's one reason why Obama called for 100% auction of all of the pollution permits was to internalize the price of carbon within the price, so you make the polluter pay. But instead, this bill is giving away 85% of all the pollution credits, which means the price of pollution, instead of internalizing the price, we're making it basically as cheap, just slightly more expensive. So what that means is that renewable energy that you and I think we would like to see, like wind and solar and wave and geothermal, that is not the low-hanging fruit. The low-hanging fruit is the dirty stuff, like taking biomass from old-growth, you know, forests, throwing them into a burner, and burning that generating energy. That is now considered renewable.
Even though burning anything, by definition, causes the creation of more greenhouse gases.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You're combusting things, you're generating CO2, but the theory is it's renewable because the forest will grow back. Of course, you know, once you do the full life cycle analysis, you understand it takes 100 years for a tree that size to grow back. In the meantime, you've lost all of that capacity to absorb CO2.
Well, the human race may not be around for another 100 years as a result.
We need to peak in the next 5 or 7 years or so and then decline. So we need to keep all of our forests standing. We need to make sure that we're not playing around with the math in order to get the cheapest possible reductions, but we're actually investing in the sort of transformative energy systems that are going to really transform this country into a leader.
My guest is Daphne Wysham. She's a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and director of the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network. If you've just tuned in, we're talking about new climate legislation that was just introduced by two Democratic representatives in the House. It's the American Climate and Energy Act of 2009. Now, Daphne, a lot of environmentalists and perhaps yourself had high hopes in the era of Obama in which to do something absolutely serious about global warming. The 8 years of Bush were seen as a major setback, not only for the U.S., but globally, given that the U.S. Is only, 4% of the world's population, but produces something like 25% of all carbon dioxide emissions. Internationally, this is an embarrassment, not only an embarrassment, but of course is putting the Earth in peril. What's going on? What are your hopes under the Obama administration of getting something much stronger with a Democratic majority in Congress, getting something much stronger that actually does something real about global warming?
Well, you know, part of the Obama budget, if people paid attention to his initial plan, there was a line item in there, $650 billion, which was assuming 100% auction of pollution permits under the Waxman-Markey bill. We now have 85% of them given away, so only 15% left. That means all of that money that was going to be going into the U.S. government coffers to pay for things like helping all of us become whole in terms of dealing with the price of energy, the poorest especially, and those in lower income, they would get some sort of tax rebate. It would help us invest in the kind of clean energy that the Obama administration has suggested they understand we need to invest in. That money has now been given away to the very polluters that we need to rein in.
If this act passes.
Sorry?
If this act passes.
If this act passes, yes. And, of course, it has to go through quite a few more hurdles, and one of them is the Ways and Means Committee. Now, we know from Congressman Rangel that he considers the Energy Committee to have no jurisdiction over setting monetary policy. And in fact, he prefers a carbon tax to, or he said he prefers a carbon tax to the cap and trade approach.
And you think that's a better idea?
Well, I think it's a better idea than cap and trade. I think we can do a lot with our regulatory system that we have in place. One other problem with this approach is that it essentially waives certain elements of the Clean Air Act. The EPA's endangerment finding that found that CO2 is a danger to human health would be waived by the language in this bill.
Wait a minute. This was a huge turnaround
yes.
from the Bush administration, under which the EPA was refusing to classify carbon dioxide as a pollutant. That was reversed, considered a huge victory. Now you're saying it's going to be unreversed?
Yes.
Wow.
As a result of this bill.
Hmm.
Now, so that's why we need to make sure we keep a very close eye on all of the, you know, and the problem is this is almost a 1,000-page bill. It keeps getting bigger. But we will have a chance to revisit it in the Science Committee and the Finance Committee, in the Ways and Means Committee, and, of course, again, in the Senate. And those of us who are concerned both about the economic issues as well as about the environmental issues, about the scientific integrity, are we, in fact, going through this entire exercise and resulting having an overall increase in our greenhouse gas emissions despite this very costly process, or are we going to achieve our overall goals, which are ultimately to get down below 350 parts per million? We are above that right now. And we're headed perilously towards 450 parts per million, if not higher, unless we in the U.S. really take a leadership role on this.
Now, I had mentioned earlier the Breakthrough Institute's suggestion that, and it sounds like you agree with them, that this bill, if it passes in its current state, would actually result in an increase in emissions, actually not do anything about global warming except worsen it. Do you buy that?
Well, you know, in 1 billion of the tons of carbon offsets are allowed overseas. 1 billion is allowed domestically. And even in the best case scenario, if you said, okay, all of those domestic carbon offsets, we will make sure that we supervise, you know, they're being doled out, and we'll make sure that they're held to the highest possible standard domestically. I can tell you, I've seen these international carbon offsets. I've seen how they are essentially subsidizing, providing perverse subsidies for the dirtiest industries overseas. They are not helping to advance our goals of a clean energy future. Something like 2/3 of all projects in China went to large hydropower projects that were already under construction, and that's considered a clean energy offset that allows for business as usual in the north.
Hmm.
So even in the best case scenario, even if you were to achieve 100%, you know, integrity with these carbon offsets, you're essentially back to square one. You're at zero because
right.
you offset your own significant pollution domestically.
You're not actually doing anything about global warming.
Anything.
But you're just saying that you're not making it necessarily, you're not continuing it at a worse rate. But
right.
just going at what we're doing right now is going to make things worse no matter what.
And so analysis that was done by International Rivers and Rainforest Action Network and others suggests that we will not see a decrease in the U.S. in our emissions due to these huge carbon offsets until 2026. That's far past the point at which we need to be reducing.
Well, very briefly, Daphne, there's a major climate conference happening later this year in December in Copenhagen, and this is where the international community comes together. Again, the U.S. grossly behind, embarrassingly so, behind the rest of the world on what we're doing about climate change. What are your hopes for that conference?
Well, my hope is that between now and August, when allegedly this bill will come to a vote, final vote on the House floor, we see a much, much stronger bill put forward. And otherwise, we're going to be the laughingstock yet again in the international climate community.
And it depends on listeners and voters and ordinary people to pressure their Democratic and other representatives to improve this bill.
And to make sure that things like, you know, renewable energy are very clearly defined as the kinds of renewable energy you would want to have in your community, not more incinerators, and the sort of carbon offsets that are a cheap trick that we get rid of them. and that we make sure that the rule of law is applied as it should be. It should not be waived.
And so just a shorter, more elegant approach that relies simply on regulation, say a 100-page bill rather than a 1,000-page bill might be the best way to go.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there are those who say, well, cap and trade is the only game in town. It's, you know, the train has left the station. If that is in fact the case, and I beg to differ because I see all sorts of flaws with it being implemented in the EU, then we have to make sure that there is absolutely the toughest standard that we are held to in this country, because we are, in fact, the number one greenhouse gas
emitter,
together with China.
When you say the only game in town, I mean, we may not have a town left for much longer if this continues. Daphne Wysham, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Daphne Wysham is a fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and director of the Sustainable Energy and Economy Network. We've been talking about the Waxman-Markey bill. That is the American Climate and Energy Act of 2009 that was just introduced into Congress. This is Uprising, and later in the hour, we will speak with Matthew Rothschild, who is the editor of the Progressive magazine, celebrating its 100th year this year. We'll also hear this week's Empire Notes. And after today's Subversive Historian, the true cost of Chevron, an alternative annual report. Stay tuned.
Greetings. I'm Chuck Foster, host of KPFK's Reggae Central. Join me Tuesday, May 26th at The Mint, 6010 West Pico Boulevard in L.A. for a special reggae edition of KPFK's Global Dance Party. I'll be spinning reggae and bringing on special guests, including Mr. Mojo of Morgan Heritage, Jessica Burks, and just added, The Expander. That's Tuesday, May 26th at The Mint, with proceeds going to benefit your favorite radio station, KPFK.
Programming on KPFK is made possible by our listener sponsors.
This is Gabriel San Roman, your subversive historian. Back in the day on May 26, 1937, the Battle of the Overpass took place between Union auto workers and Ford servicemen. After the UAW had organized effective sit-down strikes against Chrysler and General Motors, the Union turned its sights on the notoriously anti-labor Ford Motor Company. Emboldened by the passage of the National Labor Relations Act 2 years prior, the UAW gained a permit to distribute leaflets at Ford's River Rouge plant as part of their Unionism, Not Fordism campaign. An hour before workers on site were set for a shift change, UAW organizers Walter Reuther and Richard T. Frankenstein were among those present posing for a newspaper photographer when they were approached and attacked by Harry H. Bennett's Ford servicemen. One man suffered a broken back as a result of the thuggery, and women organizers were beaten as well. Ford and his henchmen, however, were taken to task for the incident of brutality when they were found in severe violation of the National Labor Relations Act. For Uprising, this is your truth professor saying it's no mystery why they conceal our people's history.
You're listening to Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. Ahead of its annual shareholder meeting tomorrow, the Chevron Corporation is facing increasing scrutiny for its business practices around the world, from California to Ecuador. The second most profitable oil company in the United States faced a continuing legal challenge just last week from a coalition of environmental groups in Richmond, California. The activists say that Chevron's plans to replace old equipment at its refinery in the city will allow for the processing of heavier crude that would lead to an increase in pollution. Meanwhile, CalPERS, a major pension fund that holds hundreds of millions of dollars in stock in the company, announced last Thursday that it planned to vote for a resolution at the annual shareholder meeting on Chevron's liability in Ecuador. The company is currently facing a decision expected this year on a $27 billion claim accusing it of polluting Amazon jungle regions in the South American country. Lawsuits such as those in California and Ecuador have inspired, in part, a new expose on Chevron detailing abuses committed by the company worldwide. The findings and conclusions of the 44-page report, entitled The True Cost of Chevron, will be announced today ahead of plans to protest outside of the company's headquarters in San Ramon, California tomorrow. My guest is Antonia Yuhas, the lead author of The True Cost of Chevron, an alternative annual report. She's also written the book The Tyranny of Oil, The World's Most Powerful Industry and What We Must Do to Stop It. Welcome to Uprising, Antonia.
Well, thanks for having me. Good morning.
Good morning. Let's first talk about Ecuador before we go to what's happening in California. I know you were on Democracy Now! This morning talking about it, and that program will re-air at 9 o'clock. But tell our listeners specifically how Chevron has been responsible for polluting in a very serious way many regions of the Amazon jungle in Ecuador, and specifically who are the people who are involved?
Sure. Well, this relates to beginning from 1964 to 1990, Texaco, which Chevron bought in 2001, was operating in Ecuador in blatant disregard for Ecuador's environmental laws, international standards for environmental laws, was intentionally cost-cutting and simply dumping toxic waste and oil into the Amazonian jungle for about 30 years' time. Texaco left in 1990, and that's when indigenous populations within Ecuador began organizing to try and demand a cleanup of the toxic spill. And literally we're talking 18 billion gallons of waste. This is larger than the Exxon Valdez spill, and this is in the Amazonian jungle, in the land of indigenous populations, and that the struggle began during that period of time, but essentially went legal in the 1990s with a court case, and the court case was brought in New York, but Texaco fought aggressively to get the case tried in Ecuador instead. The primary reason being that they planned all along, and this continues to be now Chevron's position, that what happens in Ecuador stays in Ecuador, and even if the ruling comes down against them, they're trying to argue that it's an Ecuadorian court and therefore they don't have to abide by the judgment. But basically, throughout this period of time, since 1993, there has been ongoing organizing among Ecuadorians, supported by activists and lawyers in the United States and really around the world, a global effort to keep attention on this case, to keep money flowing to the case, to keep media focused on the case, and it now appears that it's going to be successful and that in the fall it looks like the Ecuadorian court is going to rule that Chevron owes an astounding $27 billion, which is really nothing compared to the health effects, the miscarriages, the cancer, the death, the livelihoods, the environmental destruction caused by this spill. But it will be the largest judgment against a corporation for anything similar. And what we tried to do with this alternative annual report is to show that while this case in Ecuador is astounding, it is unfortunately not atypical, and that we see a similar and blatant disregard for law, environmental law, public health, the environment, communities, human rights, with Chevron's operations across the United States and around the world.
And how profitable is this company? I mean, you mentioned it's the second largest in the country, or the world, I should say. How, you know, what are some of the numbers, particularly given the state of the economy today?
Well, yes. So it's the largest corporation in California, and that's important for us to remember, particularly during our budget traumas.
So largest corporation, period, not just oil company, but largest corporation in California.
Hands down, the largest corporation in California. It's the second largest oil company in the United States. It's the sixth largest corporation in the entire world, period, of any type of company. It is an enormous company. The only reason why we don't pay as much attention to it as we should is because it's so dwarfed by Exxon, which is the largest corporation on the planet. But Chevron holds its own, and it made $24 billion in profits last year. CEO David O'Reilly was the 15th highest compensated CEO of any American CEO, $50 million in total compensation just last
50?
year. 50? An enormous amount, and Chevron is also the dominant player of any business in California politics. And what we are demonstrating through this report is that while Chevron in many ways has had its best year ever, even this last quarter, its profits did take a dip, but its shares went up because it is seen as the sort of nicer oil company in comparison to Exxon, which is an absolute myth for many reasons. But what we were trying to show is that that is really a house of cards, that financial status is built up on lies, misdirection to shareholders about Chevron's liabilities, and practices that are unsustainable given the organizing of the movements of those communities that are affected by those practices.
And explain where the decision by CalPERS, this fund that I mentioned, pension fund, their decision to try to introduce a resolution on Ecuador at the shareholder meeting tomorrow, is that based on any interaction with some of these movements, these Amazon movements, Ecuadorian movements, people's movements? Are they coordinating, or is this something that you think that they came up with on their own just from knowing about and understanding the situation?
Yeah, and this is such a good question, so important for activists to understand. This is the result of long-term organizing and activism and education that has taken a long time to have an effect but has worked, and that is the ongoing dialogues, education, discussions between the activists from Ecuador, from the United States, meeting with CalPERS, which is the largest public pension fund in the country, an enormous holder of stock in Chevron. Through a very a long process of dialogue and activism and reaching out, making the decision to support a resolution that calls on Chevron to come clean for its actions in Ecuador. And this is really an enormous victory of activism that could ultimately have a tremendous financial benefit to a incredibly devastated community.
So, did they actually get in touch with, or were they approached by the movements, or were there American activists that were sort of acting as go betweens, people like yourself?
Yeah, I wasn't directly involved, so I don't feel completely comfortable talking about how the dialogue mm-hmm. happened. All I do know for certain that this was not an independent action of CalPERS. This was a long time coming.
And there are other funds as well, from New York. There's also public pension funds in Connecticut, Pennsylvania, Maryland, pension funds of firefighters and police in Detroit and other large cities that have announced their support for a resolution on Ecuador. So it's a pretty important thing happening tomorrow. Antonia Juhas is my guest. She's lead author of the report that we're discussing that's going to be announced today. The results of it are going to be announced today. It's called The True Cost of Chevron, an alternative annual report, a day ahead of the company Chevron's annual shareholder meeting. There's going to be a protest happening there tomorrow. Let's turn to California, Antonia, and talk about this issue in California that Chevron is also having to deal with about replacing aging equipment. What's the main issue there, and is that also coming up as a result of local activism?
Yeah, this is a case of Chevron trying to frame what it's doing in the best possible light, the upgrading of equipment. What Chevron is actually trying to do and has been slowly doing at its refineries across the United States until it met the well-organized community of Richmond is to retool its refineries so that they can burn heavier, dirtier oil, in this case from the Alberta tar sands, that is more polluting when it is refined, and to retool their refinery so that it can burn this heavier oil. Thanks to the organizing and efforts of the well-organized Richmond community, which is a largely low-income community of color that has borne the brunt of this 100-plus-year-old refinery in its midst that operates in complete noncompliance with clean air standards, releasing toxic waste into the community, they found out that what Chevron was really up to and have been involved in an ongoing legal battle with the city and with the company to stop this retooling effort. And what is fantastic about the organizing is that it's also directly linked with the communities in the Alberta tar sands, the First Nation communities, the communities that live around that production that are trying to halt the production in the tar sands. Well, now you have a lawsuit in Richmond at the point of refining, where what the lawsuit is trying to say is banning the ability of Chevron to refine that type of oil at all.
And now, what is the problem with retooling? I mean, just when you say retooling, are you saying that instead of setting up a facility that is specifically designed to deal with the dirtier oil, that it is jerry-rigging the existing one and that is actually leading to more pollution? Is that accurate?
It's making it possible for the refinery to burn the heavier crude.
So the community is opposed to the heavier crude being burned regardless of what equipment it's on?
Right, because the burning of the heavier crude is inherently more polluting. There's no way to do it without creating more pollution. So they want to ban that type of refining altogether.
Antonia, finally, what's happening tomorrow specifically? Who are some of the people who are going to be present outside the shareholder meeting in San Ramon? Will it include people from Alberta, Canada, as well as Richmond and Ecuador?
Yes, and we really want to encourage people to hop in their cars and come up and join us. And
Biodiesel cars, hybrid cars, take the train.
and join us in front of San Ramon, Chevron's world headquarters. There's going to be people coming representing Chevron's operations and opposition to them in Kazakhstan, in Burma, in Nigeria, in the Philippines, Ecuador, from Richmond, from groups will be represented from Alaska and Florida, from all over the world in the country to protest outside of Chevron's headquarters. We're going to have a theater. And many of us, including myself, are actually going to go into the shareholder meeting with the use of proxies and try and share the results of our report with the shareholders. So it should be quite a good action. And we're going to also have what we're calling a sub-advertisement theater. If you go to our website, truecostofchevron.com, you'll see our mock ads showing the hypocrisy of Chevron's human energy ad campaign. Ours are Chevron inhumane energy advertisements.
That's truecostofchevron.com. So there's going to be political theater. You're going to be sneaking into the shareholder meeting. Reminds me.
Walking right through the front gate. We've got proxies.
It reminds me of when I snuck you into the Republican National Convention last year, Antonia.
Yes, you did.
Antonia, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. Best of luck tomorrow. Again, it's truecostofchevron.com. And is that also the website where listeners can find out the exact details of the address, et cetera, if they want to hop into their cars or take the train or bus down to the meeting?
Sure can. Plenty of details, and share those details with your Bay Area friends, and you can also download the report on the website as well.
TrueCostOfChevron.com. Again, Antonia, thanks as always.
Thank you for having me.
Antonia Yuhas is lead author of The True Cost of Chevron, an Alternative and Annual Report. Again, TrueCostOfChevron.com. This is Uprising. After this week's Empire Notes, we will speak with Matthew Rothschild about the Progressive. It turns 100 years old this year. Stay tuned. Empire Notes are weekly commentaries filed by Rahul Mahajan, author of Full Spectrum Dominance and the New Crusade. Today's commentary is on Guantanamo and American culture.
At first glance, the debate over the fate of detainees, if or when the prison at Guantanamo Bay is shut down, is simply a meaningless theater of the absurd. After all, one can see politicians on both sides of the aisle, opinion leaders and cable news talking heads, who've obviously watched too many summertime blockbuster movies, and seem to believe that these men have superpowers which would enable them to magically escape from supermax prisons in the United States and wreak death and destruction across the country. They have ample grassroots support for this, coming from a combination of the most idiotically reflexive, not-in-my-backyard mentality, and a perception from the right wing that there's potential for political gain here, and that their shock troops should be thrown into the battle. There are voices of sanity. When this whole issue first came up months ago, liberal bloggers were out in front, as they often are, explaining that closing the prison did not mean letting the detainees go, a misrepresentation the right wing has been very fond of, that domestic supermax prisons would be just as secure as Guantanamo, that they couldn't corrupt their naive, idealistic fellow inmates because they'd be on 23-hour lockdown. Eventually, some Democratic politicians screwed up the courage to repeat the obvious. While conservatives like Max Baucus and Ben Nelson have been happy to repeat the nonsense of Republicans, Dick Durbin, Dianne Feinstein, and Carl Levin have all bucked the NIMBY trend. King of the Influence peddlers John Murtha happily followed, salivating at the thought of federal funding to build a supermax in his district. Even so, the fact that this has become an issue at all would be shocking if we were not also inured to this kind of nonsense by now. After all, this controversy has nothing on the war on Christmas. On more reflection, however, I think that the controversy is actually important because it illuminates some of the most detestable things about American culture. One, of course, is the extreme stupidity of so many of our political debates. This is most noticeable on the Republican side, where there's a self-sustaining complex of utterly cynical, self-serving ideologues, profoundly ignorant politicians, and a large public constituency that loves the idea of going through life without a new thought ever violating their minds. Indeed, it's gotten so bad that conservative intellectuals, those few that have any principles, are deserting in droves. But the right has no monopoly on stupidity. Witness the main argument the liberals give for closing Guantanamo, that it makes us less safe because it creates more terrorists. Of course, it is true that every one of the loud, flashy crimes that we committed early in the war on terror contributed to the atmosphere of resentment and anger that is key to jihadist recruiting. Among them, let's not forget the invasion of Iraq or the first assault on Fallujah. In Iraq itself, that last had more of an effect on the population than the Abu Ghraib torture photos. On the other hand, Americans seem to be completely unaware of the level and nature of coverage of these crimes in the Arab world. People there see pictures of civilians killed by drone strikes, testimony from former detainees, stories about treatment of prisoners in Bagram, all the things that are so easily forgettable here. Closing the prison at Guantanamo may make some small statement, but potential jihadis know what a minuscule piece of the whole picture it is. Oddly enough, their opinions are not formed by the highly constrained debate so popular in the United States. Even more fundamentally, though, the debate epitomizes the deeply American value of reflexive certainty that we should never even risk paying a price for any of the crimes we commit. The real issue over detainees is not the fate of those who are convicted of terrorist acts, but that of those who cannot be convicted. Instead of patting ourselves on the back for being willing to entomb them in living death on the U.S. mainland, we need to address our actual obligations. Generally, we release prisoners who we think are guilty but whom we cannot convict. Apparently, that is unthinkable in this case, even though undoubtedly many of them are innocent and others guilty only of attacking foreign troops occupying their country. Barack Obama wants to institutionalize the war on terror as a permanent part of our politics by articulating a policy of preventive detention. The alternative is to let go of our reflexive desire to smash anyone who might conceivably pose a threat and attempt to offer amends. It might even make us safer in the long run. For Empire Notes, this is Rahul Mahajan.
Visit www.empirenotes.org for more information. You're listening to Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. This year, Pacifica Radio celebrates its 60th year and KPFK its 50th year of existence. And even though we in public radio are excited about these milestones, this year also marks a century of progressive media in print. Simply called The Progressive, the magazine of radical dissent and analysis has been around since 1909 and still going strong, keeping alive a legacy that includes everyone from James Baldwin and Upton Sinclair to Howard Zinn and Arundhati Roy. With the advent of the internet, print media is in peril, most dramatically seen in the newspaper industry, but magazines are also floundering. And yet a publication like The Progressive, with a dedicated subscribership, has survived for 100 years and plans to continue for 100 more. A new book celebrating the centennial called Democracy in Print showcases the best of The Progressive magazine, featuring thematically grouped articles that have appeared in the magazine. Themes include renouncing empire, weaving a safety net, and joining the cause of gay liberation. Authors include a plethora of well-known progressives like Edward Said, Bertrand Russell, Eduardo Galeano, Alice Walker, and many, many others. My guest is Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive magazine. He also hosts Progressive Radio, and he's the author of You Have No Rights, Stories of America in an Age of Repression. Welcome to Uprising, Matthew.
Hey, Sonali, thanks for having me on. Great introduction.
Thank you very much for joining us. So this is a very important year for The Progressive, and I rattled off several names. But for listeners who might not be familiar with it, who might not have seen it on their newsstand, how would you describe the magazine in just a few words?
Sure. Well, The Progressive has been around for 100 years. We're a magazine on the left, avowedly and not unapologetically, actually unapologetically on the left. And we have some of the best writers in the country writing for us, including Howard Zinn and Barbara Ehrenreich and Eduardo Galeano. We do investigative reporting. I do a lot of stuff on civil liberties, what I call the new McCarthyism. We've been very critical of U.S. intervention for 100 years, but especially recently about the Iraq War and the Afghanistan War. And we're critical of the policies of the State of Israel, actually most recently over the weekend when Israel busted or tried to bust the Palestinian Festival of Literature, second annual, if you can believe that.
Hmm. Well, what is the history of how this magazine started 100 years ago? And, you know, of course, it would have been a very, very different media landscape 100 years ago compared to today. If you can put it in context and explain that history, I think it would help us appreciate it better.
Sure, Sonali. It was founded by Robert La Follette, the senator from Wisconsin, who was upset about the corporate media, what he called the kept press. And there's a problem with the corporate media even back then. He didn't think he could get a fair shake out of the local media here in Wisconsin, so he decided to establish his own magazine, which originally was called La Follette's Weekly. And it turned into The Progressive and changed its name in 1929. But he understood that corporations had way too much power over the media. He recognized the need for independent media. In fact, you know, he talked about, you know, if you want to be free in this country, you really need to establish a free and independent press all across the country. So some of those same issues are still with us today. And we've taken it from there. I mean, we've done media criticism by, you know, everyone from Ben Bagdikian to George Seldes and now Robert McChesney. But here is Fighting Bob La Follette writing in 1920. Let me just read you a paragraph.
Sure.
The power that controls the press controls the American market. It's doubtful if the American people can ever emancipate themselves from the merciless exploitation of the colossal monopoly which controls markets and prices until they establish a free and independent press. Men and women of America, he said, do you want to break the stranglehold of monopoly? Do you want to be free, economically and politically free? Then begin at once. Organize, organize in every state for a free and independent press.
Hmm.
La Follette. And it's interesting, you talked about economically and politically free. That has always been a central theme, that not only do we need to be politically free in this country, we need to be economically free from these huge corporations that dominate our lives.
So, Matthew, over 100 years, how has the magazine changed? You know, what has the evolution been, not only in terms of the content, but even in terms of the writers? Obviously, you're tapping into the contemporary progressive writers of the day, but has the magazine had a specific efforts over the years to diversify its authorship, to try to, you know, reach different readerships?
Well, we certainly have changed. There have been different periods of the progressive. Actually, the early period was one of the most exciting periods. I hope this current period is exciting, too. But I went back and read from the very beginning. And from 1909 to 1920, for instance, the progressive was a suffragist magazine. It was a feminist, mm-hmm. avowedly feminist magazine. And it campaigned wholeheartedly for women's suffrage. Jane Addams was in there. Helen Keller was in there. Belle Case La Follette, the wife of Fighting Bob La Follette, was a tremendous feminist here in Wisconsin. And she'd go on train trips with Jane Addams. They'd speak out the back of the train to groups all across the Midwest, and she was a champion of women's rights and African-American rights. She wasn't your typical senator's wife. When she was in Washington in the 19-teens, she'd write letters to Woodrow Wilson saying he had to desegregate the printing office, the U.S. printing office, because the cafeteria was segregated and three young black women had been fired because they were sitting in the wrong place, and she went to bat for them and got them their jobs back, actually. So this commitment to civil rights, whether it's women's rights, African-American rights, gay and lesbian rights, has been a constant. The thing that has changed over time was, you know, who's writing for the magazine, how the magazine, I mean, is the magazine having a lot of senators write for it? For instance, in the 1950s and 60s, it was like the liberal wing of the Democratic Party. You'd have Adlai Stevenson and Hubert Humphrey in there, and JFK even, and Harry Truman even. But in the last 30 years, we haven't, or 40 years, really, we haven't gone in that direction.
And let me, on that issue, ask you, you know, how important is it for a media institution to evolve constantly depending upon the context it's in? Because as you said, you know, there was a time when it was the liberal wing of the Democratic Party, but of course, the liberal wing of the Democratic Party today, or the Democratic Party entirely today, is very much part of many many, many problems. And so I'm assuming you've moved quite, I mean, I know you've moved very far away from that just from judging your current writers.
Yeah, we're a significant distance from the Democratic Party today. Even in the 50s, they had pacifists who were opposed to U.S. entry into the Korean War, for instance, writing for the Progressive. But it was dominated by those liberal, traditional liberal voices who were comfortable enough with corporate power, comfortable enough with the United States being an empire, that that makes me a little bit uncomfortable and made my predecessor Irwin Noll uncomfortable. So we rarely have articles by senators now. We did have Russ Feingold's speech when he was the sole senator to oppose U.S. entry into the U.S. Patriot Act, support for the Patriot Act. He was quoted on that, and we did have a few voices who were opposing U.S. entry into the Iraq War. But typically, we go to social critics because we think that distance is important. And yes, it's important to evolve as a magazine. When I got here in the early 1980s, the Progressive was like, Nuclear Times. I mean, it was obsessed with the issues of nuclear war, which are very important to pay attention to even today. But there wasn't a lot of diversity either in content or in the people writing for the magazine. It was a very white, very male publication.
And today, Alice Walker and lots of Huey Long. Of course, you have Molly Ivins, the late Molly Ivins. Who are some of the Chuck D? I'm just reading off of some of the names that are featured in the book.
Yeah, we made a concerted effort over the years to get other voices in the magazine rather than just having it be a monotone. We wanted to have, you know, a lot of different voices echoing off each other, sometimes disagreeing with each other. And so, you know, we had June Jordan writing for us for many years, and what a pleasure that was, the great essayist and poet from Berkeley there. And she wrote some of her most powerful essays for the Progressive. We've included a couple of those in Democracy in Print, including an incredible piece on Mike Tyson, who grew up in a neighborhood near to hers in Brooklyn. And this was after he'd been convicted of rape, and I assigned her to write something on it. And I thought she was going to just take the easy route and excoriate him. She did want him to face justice and take full responsibility for his horrible actions, but she took a rare step and really empathized with his upbringing and how a monster like this is created by our society. Mm. And so I think that's one of the best essays
so
in here.
So would you say, Matthew, that the book that commemorates the centennial, the Best of the Progressive magazine, 1909 to 2009, is called Democracy in Print. This is not just a sampling of the magazine and, a sense of what this magazine has been historically. It's, in a way, a history book on its own of the last 100 years.
Exactly. I mean, I don't want the left book to be a Progressive magazine bubble bath. I mean, we're not there just to splash around and celebrate how great we are and have fun doing that. What I want to have happen for the reader who picks up this book, Democracy in Print, is to really understand what progressivism is about and what the struggle over the last 100 years has been about and the gains that we've made and the gains that we still have to make. We, as the progressive movement generally, and this is a representative of left-wing progressivism, because after all, there are different kinds of progressivism. People bandy the term out a lot. Even back in the day, I mean, there was Teddy Roosevelt's progressivism, which was an imperialist progressivism.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he loved the Spanish-American War, fought in it. He loved every war he could lay his hands on and urged the United States to get into World War One and just sullied the name of anyone who opposed U.S. entry into World War One as a traitor. Well, Robert La Follette himself opposed U.S. entry into World War One and was almost kicked out of the Senate for it. We've continued that anti-imperialist progressive tradition.
Matthew Rothschild, I mentioned earlier the print industry being in peril this time, particularly the newspaper industry. Does the Progressive employ a particular economic model that other print institutions and media institutions in general could learn from? I mean, Pacifica Radio, of course, sets itself apart as being entirely listener-sponsored, more than 90% listener-sponsored, doesn't take underwriting. How does the Progressive function economically?
Well, we're like Pacifica. I mean, we beg and borrow. I mean, and we're shameless about it. I don't know how shameless you are, but we're very shameless. I'm going to be calling, I'm going to make about 500 calls or 400 calls this week asking people to donate above and beyond the price of their subscription, but I'm asking people who've already done that many years. So that's how we survive. We survive and have always survived by the grace of our and generosity of our subscribers who pay on top of what it costs to get the subscription.
So no ads.
No, we have ads. We're slutty that way. We'll take ads from anybody. We don't want to set ourselves up as censors, actually. So we will take ads from anybody. But we don't have a lot of advertising. Advertising is certainly less than 10% of our total revenue.
And in terms of how the Progressive has managed to weather this storm, well, the storm is certainly not over. Are there any specific approaches that you've taken? And you know, as we've seen many small print magazines go out of business, is there a plan to expand in online? I know you certainly do have a website, but what are future plans to keep the Progressive going for another 100 years?
Well, we're concentrating on this problem, though I think our problem is easier than the problem of newspapers, which I think are going to die out. I mean, we're seeing their corpses on the sidewalks every day, and, you know, their existential reason for being has expired because, you know, they used to say you can wrap a dead fish in yesterday's newspaper. Well, you can wrap a dead fish in today's newspaper because by the time it hits your front stoop, it's already old. And that's not true of what we're trying to do at the Progressive, because we aren't so much concerned about what Barack Obama said at his announcement today of a Supreme Court nominee.
Right, it's long-term analysis.
Yeah, we try to look more long-term. We try to detect trends and issues. We try to bring forward investigative pieces that no one else is doing. We bring voices to the table that people aren't listening to. I mean, we've had Eduardo Galeano writing for us for years before Hugo Chavez gave his book to Barack Obama. So
that's right.
This is the kind of thing that we do, and we try to present a picture that is a little more holistic than the bit by bit you get in either in newspapers or on the internet.
Matthew Rothschild, I want to wish you the best of luck, and thanks so much for joining us today.
Sonali, it's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Matthew Rothschild is editor of the Progressive magazine, and you can find out more online at progressive.org, including subscription information, I'm sure. We've been talking about the book also that has just been released to commemorate the centennial of the Progressive. It's called Democracy in Print. And by the way, KPFK's 50th anniversary global reggae dance party is happening tonight at the Mint, emceed by Reggae Central's Chuck Foster. Doors open at 7 p.m. All proceeds benefit KPFK. The Mint is located at 6010 West Pico Boulevard at Crescent Heights in L.A. More info at kpfk.org. For Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day. The free press is the mother of all our liberties and of our progress under liberty. Adlai Stevenson said that. That's Sonali, Subversive Thought for the Day. You've been listening to Uprising. To get a CD of today's show, contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or online at pacificaradioarchives.org. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Jazz Shepherd is our engineer. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening.